conversation or calendar is 95-1627 in the matter of the estate of Helen F. Eichel, deceased. Mr. Swick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, and my co-counsel, Lloyd Dooley. I'm here on behalf of the appellant to ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision, which in effect changed what has been the law in Ohio for approximately 200 years. In doing this, the Court of Appeals has put into effect a rule which is more complicated, which is going to result in more litigation, and which completely ignores the rules of agency. What the Court of Appeals did was replace the identity theory of adoption with the intention theory. There's no question but that application of the rule that we want this court to follow will have a harsh result in this case. But I think the court is aware that it has to look at the system as a whole. It has to look long term. There's no question that
the intention theory is not original with this Court of Appeals, is it?
Your Honor, other courts of appeals and other states have adopted the intention theory, and I think that, as a matter of fact, probably a majority of states in the United States do follow the intention theory.
Why shouldn't we take the enlightened view of other states?
Well, I guess I wouldn't concede that that's the enlightened view. A couple years ago, this court, in the case of Wright v. Bloom, which I think Justice Resnick authored, decided against the intention theory in joint and survivorship accounts, which usually take place in probate court litigation. They did that for a couple of reasons, and one of the reasons was that the intention theory, in Justice Resnick's words, has led to resolution of the issue on a case-by-case basis involving protracted litigation and great expense.
Isn't the enactment of 2107, 501B by the Ohio legislature recently more on point with the subject we have here today, where the General Assembly has allowed an exception to redemption where their guardian, an incumbent, has sold the property?
What I would say to that, Your Honor, and I understand that you were one of the justices that did not want to take this case, and I don't know if that was the reason why, but that statute protects guardians. It does not apply to powers of attorney. Now, in 1987, I believe, there were amendments to the Uniform Probate Code which inserted language which would protect in a power of attorney situation. Ohio has never adopted that amendment, and it
would make the distinction for me
between a power of attorney and a guardian.
I know you said that you believe they're distinct, but
they are definitely distinct. If I give you a power of attorney and you do something under that power of attorney, it's exactly as if I did it myself. You are my alter ego. And the case law holds
I'm incompetent.
No, that doesn't change. But let me tell you the difference, and then I'll tell you why the incompetency doesn't matter. So when you do it for me, it's just as if I did it. Now, a guardian is appointed by the court. A guardian is not the alter ego of the ward. And the case law, I've cited in my brief, specifically holds that. Now, let's say that now I'm incompetent. Does that revoke your authority to act under my power of attorney? It does not. In the first place, in this case, and in any case that there's a valid power of attorney, the person, when they give the power, has to be competent. That's a gift, or else the power of attorney is not valid to begin with. But in this particular case, and this is in the supplement to the brief that I filed, I put in the power of attorney, and it specifically provides that at paragraph 8, and this is on page 6 of the supplement to the record, that in the event of my disability or incompetency, from whatever cause, this power of attorney shall not thereby be revoked. And I think you can read that at whatever you do stand regardless of whether I'm incompetent or not. And that's why I think that a power of attorney is much different than a guardianship. A guardian is completely controlled by the court. I know that in Hamilton County, where I'm from, if the guardian wants to do basically anything, they have to get court approval. A power of attorney, if you want to sell my real estate, you don't have to get court approval. You simply have to have the power.
And therein, so therein does that line of danger. If you have a person who's going in for surgery who knows that the risks are that they may end up in a coma, and they exercise the power of attorney, they go to their surgery, they do end up in a coma. You now have the power of attorney to act for the person who's incompetent. Actually, that's not much different than somebody who doesn't exercise the power of attorney, goes into surgery, ends up in a coma, and is now under guardianship appointed by the court. In fact, the guardianship is even a safer situation because you have a court overlooking what the guardian does. Now you have an attorney, in fact, who could be a relative who says, oh, I'm going to change all of this under the will. I'll sell all this property. Therefore, it's deemed, and the money doesn't go to the other person, it'll all go to me. The use is there under either scenario because you don't have the effect of what the testator wanted going into play. Isn't that the key distinction?
Well, that's true that in this situation, if a guardian had been appointed, we would have a different result. But when a person comes in to talk to an attorney for a power of attorney or will or whatever, those things are hopefully explained to the person that this is what is going to happen when you give somebody a durable power of attorney or just a general power of attorney. And that's up to the person who, the principal in this case, to make that decision whether they want to give that or not. If they don't trust...
Most attorneys advise their clients that giving a power of attorney allows them to change their entire will?
I think that most attorneys, when they come in, and in this situation the will was written before the power of attorney, about 2 years, I think that they tell people that they are allowed to sell property, they can do anything, and if the property is not there, if you give, and I know that when most wills are written, let's say that I will to you my mother's wedding ring, the person who is writing the will is always told, now if you don't have your mother's wedding ring at the time you die, Justice Stratton is not going to get it. And that's the same with the power of attorney. It is explained to people that, you know, this allows the person to do basically anything. He's acting as you. It is you. And that's the real problem with what the Court of Appeals did, is that it completely ignored the rules of agency. And what they did completely changes the rules of agency in that the agent is acting as the principal. In that situation, a guardian is not. And that's why there should be a distinction. Otherwise, you're going to have to rewrite the whole rules of agency, and I think that that's a problem. I also think that you're going to see a lot more litigation with this type of situation. Instead of simply looking at, as in the case from 200 years ago, is the horse there or not, you're now going to have to delve into what the intent of the testator was. And I'm sure the appellee will say, well, the intent is whatever the will said, Mrs. Bodker gets the house. But I'm not so sure that's the end of the story. I think that to determine the intent, you're going to have to talk to Mr. Nemeth, who was her neighbor, who is the executor of the estate. You're going to have to talk to Mrs. Bodker. You're going to have to talk to the attorney who drafted the will and drafted the power of attorney to make sure that the intent didn't change after the will was drawn.
Is there another distinction, and that is that guardians are appointed by the court, power of attorney, agents are not?
Absolutely. That I think,
and 501 specifically says guardian. The definition of guardian is somebody appointed by the court.
That's right. And as I was explaining to Justice Cook, these amendments have not been, the Uniform Probate Code amendments, which insert power of attorney, have not been adopted by Ohio. And they inserted guardian, they left out power of attorney. And as I understand it, going back to law school, if you put in something, put in one thing but leave in something else, it's presumed that you put in what you wanted to and that you didn't put in what you didn't want to put in. And we think that the Court of Appeals has done something that, if it's going to be done at all, should be done by the legislature. The legislature's had 9 years to adopt these amendments and it hasn't done that. And I believe we'll say guardians and powers of are similar. They are similar, there's no question, but there is an important distinction appointed by the court, and one is the alter ego and one is not. Go back to law school again. They say you have to compare apples with apples. Powers of attorney and guardianships are not apples and apples. That's comparing apples and oranges.
Who do you really represent here?
I represent the executor of the estate.
Does any of this matter to the executor?
As a matter of fact, it does not matter to the executor. He is a neighbor. He's not a relative. He's
not affected in any way.
No, he's a neighbor. And actually, Mr. Dooley represents the estate. And when this claim was made and it got into litigation, they called me to handle the litigation. And, you know, we looked at what the law in Ohio has been for a long time and said it's not there.
I understand that. I want to go back to the procedural issue. So whatever we do doesn't affect an alleged party of interest. All you're doing is here preserving, or attempting to preserve, maybe not esoteric, but certainly a proposition of law that you think is old and fundamental and should not be changed.
Well, what will happen, there's $48,000 approximately that resulted from the sale of this home. If the court adopts the intention theory and says Mrs. Botker should get it, then she obviously gets the $48,000. If the court says no, it's been a deed, that $48,000 then goes into the estate and gets passed through the residuary clause to the other beneficiaries of the estate.
I understand what will happen to it. Are the other beneficiaries pushing the executor to spend the money to bring this all the way to the Supreme Court?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they have authorized us each step along the way from probate court to court of appeals and then up to the Ohio State.
So that the fiduciary in this case, your allegation would be, is representing more than the estate, derivatively, he's also representing the beneficiaries, the other beneficiaries.
I think technically, Your Honor, that he represents the estate and we represent the estate. I assume that in doing that, these other beneficiaries will benefit from what we're doing.
If he only represents the estate and you only represent him, and the estate is not going to be harmed either way because the estate doesn't have a viable stake in the claim, then do you not have a lack of a case or controversy?
No, because I guess when you say that you represent the estate, the question really then is, what is the estate? And I think the estate is really, who's going to get the money under the estate?
Well, that's what I said, but
yeah.
You said no.
Well, I think technically, when you look at the pleadings and you say who you represent, it's the executor, but the ultimate outcome is that these other beneficiaries, and I believe there's six nieces and nephews that are the ones that would benefit under it. I see that I have 2 minutes left, and I would like to reserve it unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swift.
Thank you.
Ms. Gothard.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Gothard, and I'm with the law firm of Hooper & Conn in Cincinnati, and I represent Patty Becker, who is a beneficiary under the last will and testament of Helen Hagel. As an initial matter, I'd like to review just a couple of the facts very briefly. Helen Hagel, prior to becoming incompetent, executed a power of attorney in which she also named my client, Patty Becker, as her attorney in fact. But for the existence, as the court now knows in its facts, but for the existence of that power of attorney, at the time Helen Hagel sustained a fall, became incompetent, and that incompetency continued for a period of 9 months, a guardian would have been appointed to oversee her affairs. Patty Becker, pursuant to the power of attorney, had the power and authority and the discretion to sell the residence. And the estate has never alleged before any court that Patty Becker breached the fiduciary duty that she owed to her principal.
Does not adopting the identity theory make every redemption case a question of fact?
I believe that the incompetency of the testator it's relatively easy to be proved. Either there is a guardianship situation, which is covered by 2107.501 of the Ohio Revised Code, or in the event of a power of attorney, there can be a physician statement that can concur as to the issue of incompetency.
I guess that was my question. If you change the law of redemption judicially to one of doing the right thing, don't we have to decide in every case then what's the right thing instead of just applying the law as we've all known it, we all grew up with it, to tell your client, you made a specific bequest here, if you really wanted to get the gold watch, don't give it away during your lifetime.
Yes, I think that it does call the testator's intent into question possibly in every case, but isn't that what we're trying to fulfill in the probate of the will, is what the testator's intent is? And to ignore that and to say, well, this thing has gone to beneficiary.
Is it your argument that in a case of incompetency, it would make a difference because it was not the intention of the testator to sell that property?
That is correct. In an issue of incompetency, someone else's act sold the property, not the testator's. When the testator, as in the case of Blue versus Bull, which is this court's decision in 1956, the testator was presumed competent. It was his lack of action that caused the result in that case. Here, we don't have the same facts. Helen Hagel was incompetent in a permanent vegetative state. The act was committed by someone else, by her attorney in fact. And therefore, and that's pretty easily proven, I believe, because Patty Becker signed the closing document in the deed, and so you can see whose act it was in that instance. The holding of Bull versus Bull placed Ohio in the category of an identity theory state in accordance with the academic community, how they view Ohio. However, the Court of Appeals decision in the case of Roderick versus Fisher advocated the adoption of the intention theory in Ohio, even though that case was a guardianship ward case where the ward, there was a guardianship for the physical rather than mental impairment of the ward. And in that case, actually, the ward did consent specifically to the sale. However, in advocating that the intention theory be adopted, the court stated in dicta that the law applicable to the act of a testator who is competent to act is helpful, but not controlling, where the act was done by a guardian and the testator was powerless to act. Also, there's an Ohio Court of Appeals decision from Franklin County in 1960, captioned Bishop versus Fulmer. In that case, the appeals court remanded the case back to the trial court for a hearing on the issue of the testator's competency. The court held that if the testator at the time of the sale did not have the capacity to make a will, and this incapacity continued from the time of the sale through the time of death, the holding of redemption would be an error. And this case arose 4 years after the Supreme Court's holding of Bull versus Bull. Additionally, the courts of the vast number of states and the common law and statutory law of this state have held generally that if property is sold, and if at the time of the sale and thereafter the testator cannot form the intent necessary to amend or revoke a will, then there should be no redemption. And by referring to the common law and statutory law of this state, I'm specifically referring to the protection afforded beneficiaries of wards in Section 2107.501, and the common law, I'm referring to the decisions of Roderick versus Fisher and Bishop versus Fulmer.
To hold for you, don't we have to specifically overrule Bull?
No, we don't. That applied to a specific set of circumstances where the testator was competent to act. It doesn't apply in all cases, what we are advocating here. What we are asking for is merely an exception to the doctrine of redemption by extension. There have been a number of recognized exceptions to that doctrine because of the harsh result that comes out of those cases, and even the estate has admitted that a holding of redemption yields a very harsh result in this case.
Doesn't that bring us back to my original question? I mean, doesn't that make every case looking for an exception to the rule? Because the ward was incompetent or competent, the ward was under duress to give a power of attorney or not. Everyone becomes a question of some fact.
In the instance of a power of attorney, yes, I would believe that would be the case.
And that's what we have here.
And that's what we have here. I think that, you know, you look at the totality of the circumstances, and the court here is to look at the circumstances in each case and determine whether the testator, at the time they executed the power of attorney, did it under free act and deed. And also, I'd like to shift gears just a moment and say, when she executed the power of attorney, she specifically gave Patty Becker the power and authority to sell the residence. And that is binding on Patty Becker. We are not alleging that that transfer, that conveyance is invalid. But what I think the court needs to do is to bifurcate the power to sell the residence and the power to alter someone's testamentary intent by amending a will. There is no the document that governs the relationship between Helen Hagel and Patty Becker was the power of attorney.
Tell me again how we do not have to overrule the specific language in the rule, among other things, says the adoption of a specific legacy is affected by the extinction of the thing or fund, as it is generally stated, without regard to the testator's intention. We don't take into account whether the testator is incompetent or competent according to the rule. How do we distinguish that without directly overruling?
Well,
that's pretty strong language.
It is strong language, and I think maybe that what you have to make the distinction is with or without regard to the testator's intent.
But that's in rule.
That is in rule. That's correct.
It says the intention of the testator makes no difference. So, intention making no difference, competency would make no difference. Isn't that fair?
That's fair.
Okay, if that's fair, then don't we have to just bite the bullet and overrule the rule? I just want to know how I can distinguish it.
I see it as a distinguished that I see that the facts of Bull versus Bull didn't have the issue of incompetency before.
That's intention.
That is intention.
And Bull deals with intention.
Perhaps it's a way I see it as adopting a mitigating circumstance. And if that is in effect overruling Bull versus Bull, then that is what I'm seeking. But I don't believe that's how the Court of Appeals saw it. They did not overrule the case. They just carved out an exception, pulled out the intention part of it, and said that they need to look to the competency of the testator at the time that the property was sold. And they did that by adopting the persuasive authority of the decisions of In Re Estate of Graham out of the state of Kansas and Funk versus Funk. And
so your argument really is that we ought to do what's fair.
Absolutely. That's what the court said.
Regardless of what the law might be.
The law has evolved and changed, and powers of attorney were not used 20 years ago as they are today. Today they're extremely popular, and they are oftentimes a viable alternative to a court-sponsored guardianship. And I believe that the estate says that these are apples and oranges. I believe they're apples. A guardianship, the only difference in this case was that Helen Hagel had the forethought to appoint someone to manage her financial affairs in the event she became incompetent. Had she not executed that document, there would have been a guardian appointed. And I don't believe that Patty Becker should lose her legacy solely because of the existence of that document.
But doesn't the power of attorney have much more broad implications and possible misuses, and shouldn't be guarded more than just lumping it in with guardian? They're not the same thing.
I see that perhaps we owe even a higher standard to principal and agent relationships precisely because there is no court supervision. And the way to prevent an abuse by a fiduciary in either selling off specifically devised assets in order to augment the residual estate or vice versa is to allow the beneficiary to receive the unexpended proceeds of the sale. Because there is no direct judicial supervision, I believe that is the proper way to remove the incentive from the fiduciary to act to breaches of her fiduciary duty or to engage in self-dealing. Because the majority of the time, the principal names an agent who is generally a family member or someone that may have an incentive down the road to act on behalf of others rather than to act on behalf of their principal. I'd like to address briefly Section 2107-501, which is the statutory protection for guardians, or for beneficiaries of wards under guardianship proceedings. This statute does not expressly protect principal and agent. My argument here is not to extend that statute, but to use it by analogy, and that if principal and agent relationships warrant or are based on the same legal principles as guardianship relationships, that the beneficiaries under a principal and agent relationship are entitled to the same protections that are provided for in the statute. The Court of Appeals understood this, and while they did not expressly extend the statute, they did adopt the holdings of NRA State of Graham and the Indiana decision of Funk versus Funk as common law in Ohio. And the Court of Appeals decision was an effort to promote fairness and consistency in the law so that similar circumstances receive similar results. I believe that the statute has a gap in it, and that the legislature, for whatever reason, has not adopted the revisions to the Uniform Probate Code. However, I don't know that they've actually ever considered them and chosen not to specifically. I think that the court can recognize the exception to the common law doctrine, and if that involves an overrule of Boole versus Boole, then I think that's what it takes to protect the intent of the testator.
The distinction on intent in Boole versus Boole is that in Boole, the testator is confident if something ends up disappearing in his estate, he still has the ability to change his will, to make effect, to take care of the problem that arises. And Boole, by inaction, did nothing until the matter was lost. But in the incompetent situation, that incompetent has no ability to rectify the problem once it occurred. And that distinction?
That is absolutely correct. The issue is the competency of the testator. In Boole, the redemption could have prompted him to desire to change his will or to take some other action. Helen Hagel did not have that luxury. She was incompetent during the whole time that the sale was contemplated and was performed. And her intent needs to be looked at as to the last expression of her intent, which is the will that she executed in 1990. And that serves as the last expression of her intent. I'd like to briefly address Appellant's argument that this court is without jurisdiction to hear this case because it is barred by the statute of limitations. Patty Becker, through the efforts of prior counsel, filed a claim against the estate, which was rejected. However, she did not meet the statutory requirements of a creditor because her claim is based on a gratuitous transfer and did not arise out of contract, court, judgment, or cognitive note. While she may have thought herself a creditor, that is not enough to make her a creditor under the statute. In conclusion, I'd like to say that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed, one, because it is the logical continuation of the cases of Roderick versus Fisher and Bishop versus Fulmer. The Court of Appeals decision furthers public policy by protecting the testamentary intent of the testator and removes the incentive of those in a fiduciary capacity from breaching their duty or promoting their own self-interest. The common law of Ohio, may I be permitted to continue?
Yes, finish your thought quickly.
Thank you. The common law of Ohio and the statutes of this and other state recognize that the beneficiaries of incompetent testators are deserving of protection, and the Court of Appeals decision comports with the rulings of the majority of the other states. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Gother. Mr. Swick, you've saved a little over a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll go quickly. To answer Justice Douglas's question, yes, every adoption case will be in the trial court if the new rule is adopted. The Appellee's counsel said this was not the principal's act. Well, it was the principal's act. She acted under a power of attorney, and it was just as if Helen Hagel sold this property. you only have to look at the document itself, the power of attorney itself, to see that it survives her incompetency.
Counsel, has that been the experience in other states that ever want to use such complex litigation?
That's a good question, Your Honor. My experience is more with, which is why I was interested in the Wright v. Bloom case, with, is more with these joint survivorship accounts, which we had a ton of them down in Hamilton County, people fighting over them. I think once you throw the issue of intent into question, then you have something to fight about. The lawyer then has something to hang his hat on.
It has to be intent, incompetence, factor of incompetence. So it won't be every redemption case. It'll be those with some argument about acting on behalf of the testator.
Of the incompetent testator. In this particular case, though, there's still a question because she wrote a will. 2 years later, after she had written the will, she wrote a power of attorney, in effect, giving the appellee the power to sell everything she owned. So what was her intent? To make sure that this real estate was devised to this person or to let this person sell everything. The last thing this lady did was give the power of attorney. She did that 2 years after she drafted the will, knowing that this allowed the person to sell everything she owned and that it would defeat the intent of the will. So when they say that the last expression of intent was the will, that's not true. The last expression of her intent was that she told, can I go on for a second?
Yes, you finish.
Told the agent that she could sell everything. You have the best library up here, and it has this 200-year-old case here, which I cannot find in any other law library. And this Lord Justice in England says, I see no end to the confusion from following any other line. And I think that's what we're looking at if we follow this new rule. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.